My name is Michaela Jordan Murray from Catskill, New York, and you're listening to WGXC Acra 90.7 FM.
Wave Farms WGXC always needs computer donations. If you have one and don't need it, and it's a Macintosh 2019 or newer, please email info@WGXC.org for more information. Thank you for your contribution.
WGXE underwriting support is provided in part by MPAC, presenting the U.S. premiere of Permanent Trespass, Beirut of the Balkans and the American Century, a performance by filmmaker Bassem Saed and writer Sanja Grozdanik, Friday, October 25th at 7 p.m. on the campus of RPI in Troy, New York. Information can be found at mpac.rpi.edu.
Wave Farms WGXC is made possible in part by the generous support of Carol Friedman in Hudson, New York. WGXC monthly supporters care deeply about Creative Community Radio. Their generosity and investment keep this unique station viable. You too can become a monthly supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and establishing a donation at the amount of your choosing. We hope you will do so. Thank you so much for your support.
Hello and welcome to the better weather for Thursday, October 17th. Local early morning temperatures range from 27 degrees in Steventown to 33 in Skodak. Snow falls today about 1,800 miles to the west over Yellowstone National Park. Over here in the Columbia and Greene counties, we get another cold morning. The mercury climbs to 57 degrees by 3 p.m. Overnight temperatures reach freezing again, hitting 32. Tomorrow will be nice and sunny with a high of 63 at 3 p.m. Overnight hits 32 again, but briefly enough for it to not be a hard freeze. Good time to think about planting next year's garlic. Saturday will be sunny with a high of 67. Sunday, same deal, hitting 71 degrees in the afternoon. Today's tide schedule is high tide at 2:59 a.m., low tide at 9:36 a.m., high tide again at 3:23 p.m., then low tide once again at 10:14 p.m. Today's river temperature will be 49 degrees and the tide strength is high. Sunset today will be at 5:57 p.m., sunrise tomorrow will be at 7:07 a.m. Looking way up, we see plasma winds will be average at 407 kilometers per second with a thin density of less than 1 proton per cubic centimeter. Radio propagation conditions are currently okay below 8 megahertz overnight only. There are no chances for aurora this evening. The current sunspot number is 135. And this has been The Better Weather, brought to you by the Catskill Makers Syndicate.
The Public News Service Friday afternoon update. I'm Mike Clifford. Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump used remarks at a Catholic charity banquet Thursday to skewer prominent Democrats, often in off-color terms. That's a take from the Washington Post. He mispronounced Vice President Kamala Harris's name and said she had no intelligence whatsoever. He made fun of her husband, Doug Emhoff, for an affair he acknowledged during a previous marriage. The Post notes the only person off-limits for Trump was himself. Trump saying, "Tradition holds I'm supposed to tell a few self-deprecating jokes this evening, so here it goes. Nope, I've got nothing. There's nothing to say." Meantime, a new poll finds Kamala Harris continues to lead Donald Trump among black likely voters in battleground states. The poll conducted by Howard University surveyed 981 black likely voters in swing states. The results showed that 84% of respondents planned to vote for the VP. Only 8% said they would support Trump. Another 8% remained undecided. And in preparation for future storms, a parish in Puerto Rico has installed a solar power system, positioning itself as a vital climate resilience hub for the local community. We get the details in this Earthbeat Solutions Journalism Florida News Connection collaboration.
This coastal community is taking proactive steps to ensure it can remain a beacon of support during the increasing threats of hurricanes. Speaking on a webinar, David Ortiz, Puerto Rico Director of Solar United Neighbors, says there is a critical need for resilience following the devastation of Hurricane Maria in 2017.
There were over 4,600 deaths. People lost electricity from 3 months to a year. Many also lost water from 3 to 6 months. Flooding devastating many towns and municipalities, including Cataño.
I'm Trebell Gomes.
Meantime, Tennessee has expanded food assistance for Northeast Tennessee residents still cleaning up after Hurricane Helene. What's known as the Disaster Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or DSNAP, is in effect for current SNAP recipients in 8 counties affected. Signe Anderson is with the Tennessee Justice Center.
With the knowledge that so many people lost power, there was major devastation.
The benefits are provided through an electronic debit card. It can be used to purchase food items at grocery stores and other authorized retailers. And a new report offers solutions for at least 119,000 young people in Connecticut who are described as being disconnected from work or school.
Disconnection means they've either dropped out or are close to dropping out of school. It also applies to young people ages 18 to 26 who are unemployed or unemployable. Kate Diaz with the Connecticut Education Association says the state making college a priority beyond high school may be a worthy goal, but it has also contributed to the disconnected issue.
We need to continue to evolve is the idea that there's a lot of opportunities.
The overall goal of the Young People First plan is to get 60,000 at-risk and disconnected youth ages 14 to 26 back on track by 2035. I'm Edwin J. Vieira.
This is Public News Service. Childhood poverty continues to plague the U.S., but with the election pending, families wonder how the outcome will affect their kids and their education. We get the details of this Yes Media Mississippi News Connection collaboration.
Nowhere is the problem of childhood poverty worse than in Mississippi, which leads all the states in the proportion of kids living below the poverty line. Experts say recent history shows that federal, state, and local programs can successfully bridge the economic gap. Michelle Bezar, a senior researcher at the Center for Early Learning Funding Equity at Northern Illinois University, says the early years are critical for kids from low-income households.
Children develop their most crucial social, emotional, motor, and early learning skills during the first 5 years of life. But this is the time in the U.S. when we invest the least in children's care and education. So the U.S. lags in early care and education and enrollment.
The U.S. Census Bureau reports that in 2022, the nationwide poverty rate for children under 18 is 16.3%, with Mississippi in 50th place, with 26.4% of kids below the poverty line.
And artificial intelligence is changing how people learn and work. Universities in North Carolina and across the country are racing to keep up.
William Peace University in Raleigh is one of them, taking part in a national program to help students develop the AI skills they need to thrive in the workplace. Linda Szymanski from WPU says it's all about giving students real-world experience and preparing them for the demands of today's jobs.
The statistic that really struck me is 66% of the leaders said they would not hire someone without artificial intelligence skills. And so we feel compelled to make sure our students have the skills that they need to be successful.
The latest Gallup poll finds 93% of Fortune 500 companies are already using AI in the workplace. Shantia Hudson reporting.
Finally, our Eric Tanganoff lets us know October is National Seafood Month.
Offshore fish farming has come to dominate wild harvest in recent decades, with farmed salmon making up 80% of global salmon supply. Oregon doesn't have regulations that stop the practice. And Johnny Fishmonger with Wild Salmon Nation says legislation proposed in Congress could make fish farming more prevalent in federal waters. He compares large-scale fish farming practices to dairy and poultry farms.
It's like on land, concentrated animal feedlot operations, CAFO. So concentrated aquaculture feedlot operations where the fish are farmed intensively in high densities.
Fishmonger notes that sea lice infestations are common and devastating problems for fish farms. The Aqua Act would allow aquaculture companies 3 miles offshore in federal waters.
This is Mike Clifford for Public News Service, member and listener supported. Here's on interesting radio stations, your favorite podcast platform. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Hello, and welcome to the WGXC Afternoon Show. This is Meredith Cooey, and I am live in the Catskills studio with a very special guest today. He'll be doing a guest show, Andrew Edwards. Hi, Andrew.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and I am also joined by Wave Farms Tech Director, Jen Cutler. Hi, Jen.
Hello.
So, Andrew, tell us a bit about what your show is going to be about today.
Yeah, well, it's going to be about the subject of disinformation, and especially disinformation in social media.
and you've been working on issues surrounding this for a long time, correct?
I have. I have kind of a background in digital analytics, which is how I got wind of all of this. And then I authored a couple of books. One of them was called Digital is Destroying Everything, and a recent one called Army of Liars. Army of Liars is really about disinformation in social media, and frankly, its deleterious effects, in my personal opinion, on civil society and democracy.
And so what are some of the things that you'll be talking about today for our listeners?
So one of the things that I have discovered as I talk to people about these issues is that there is a remarkable lack of awareness of why we live in the world we live in terms of what surrounds us in media, and especially in what is called social media. And so I will be talking about the underlying causes for that, one of them being a law that was created in 1996. It's called Section 230 of the 1996 Communications Decency Act, of which there is much to say.
And so for our listeners, a little bit about you. Who are you?
Yeah. So, I live in the Hudson area, and I have a background in, I guess you would say, this is going back a ways, web development. I built some of the very first websites that were ever made back in the 1990s. And then I also co-founded the Digital Analytics Association in 2002. And I've been kind of studying, I spent a long time studying user behavior on behalf of clients that I had. And so I learned about how these companies, most of them brick and mortar companies, how they see data as a platform for decision making. And later, as I moved out of that and more into a kind of more generalized outlook on it, I started to think about, well, data is another word for factual information. And large organizations, which have a lot riding on their decisions, learned to rely on data and facts that they learned about their digital properties in order to make business decisions about what they would be doing next. And so it began to occur to me that none of us are really all that different from them in terms of how we need to make decisions about things we are going to do. And much of, we may not really appreciate it, but much of the decisions we make really do need to be supported by, for lack of a better word, data and facts, which can come in many, many different forms. And so it really started to seem to me that with the advent of what's called social media, we started to see a diminution, in other words, less of truth, if you will, or facts, if you will, and kind of an emphasis on uploaded content, which had a very strong tendency to be either intemperate or misinformation, which is just merely incorrect information, or disinformation, which is information that's wrong on purpose in order to get some kind of result, often a political result. And so that's kind of where I got to, where I was writing these books, and began also doing some talks at libraries, and noticing it really stood out to me how little even very informed people know about some of these topics.
Jen, do you have anything?
I have a question. What, yeah. What is your main goal for this broadcast?
Well, I am hoping to make people aware enough of the fact that social media is not a force of nature. Social media is, they are businesses, and they are they are built on the basis of a law which could be changed. And if that law changes, then these companies would have to change. And the amount of disinformation and, for instance, violent and harmful content would probably begin to be reduced, because it would create a downside for them. And right now they have no downside.
Well, here you go.
Yeah.
On with your show.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for being here.
Yeah.
Thanks for coming in.
Thank you. So, folks, I know it's kind of a heavy lift to get from where we are now to maybe a better place in the world, if I may say so. But I do think that one of my goals is to educate folks about, you know, really what we're up against, and also the fact that this can be changed. I run into a lot of people in all kinds of situations where I will, you know, the topic will be, okay, what about disinformation? And my take on it is, yes, we are in a world where we're likely to hear a lot of untrue things that are targeted at us by social media. And there's kind of almost a sense of despair with some people that it's not possible to do anything about it, that these companies are simply too large, and that we're just kind of stuck with it. And I find that this is an unfortunate point of view, and I think it's very, very widespread, especially perhaps among a younger generation that may not remember that there was a time when there was no such thing as social media. And so when I talk about, you know, people saying, well, we can't fix it, my answer to them is, oh, but you can. And I'm here to tell you that, yes, you can, but I don't want to make it seem like it would ever be easy to do this, but I think we have to have some starting points. And that's kind of where I am going to start with today. So I think you may have heard at the outset that I mentioned the difference between misinformation and disinformation. Both of these can be problematic, but only one of them is on purpose. Misinformation is, obviously, it's incorrect, but a lot of times it's just someone who heard something and repeated it, and it wasn't right, and they didn't know it was wrong, and it gains currency because it keeps getting repeated. But it may be a misconception. It may just be a misunderstanding. It may not have been invented by someone on purpose and disseminated on purpose in order to gain any particular result. Nevertheless, misinformation is always a problem. Secondly, disinformation is also incorrect information, but much more importantly, it is done on purpose. So there are a lot of bad actors out there, and I call them cynical manipulators, who either domestic or foreign, often utilizing AI and hacking techniques, create stories that are simply untrue. And many of these, unfortunately, have a political aspect to them, and people will hear them, and because of the way social media operates, they may end up hearing them a lot, and hearing these this sort of disinformation kind of over and over again. When I say hear, I also mean see and read, because social media remains largely textual, although of course there's video now. But I think my point is that they are exposed to these messages, and of course when one hears the same thing over and over, at a certain point it becomes it seems to make sense that one should accept it as true. So there's a couple things I want to say about that. Before I get into Section 230, I just want to say a word about what I call echo chambers, which is a word that describes the way that people sort of become surrounded by either information or disinformation, depending on the situation. I'll point out an example, which I think will illustrate what an echo chamber is. So essentially, it is a world where what you are exposed to and what you hear and what you read is comfortable for you. And it's you are not out of your comfort zone. You're hearing things that make good sense to you and which make you feel better about the decisions you're making. It does not mean that the information you've been receiving to make your decisions has been in any way correct, but it does mean that it's probably of a consistent nature. And I would hasten to add that this cuts across all political stripes. Everyone is naturally and in social media in some kind of echo chamber. And an echo chamber essentially is a lot like living in a town and never leaving your town. It feels very comfortable. Everything looks familiar. But you're not going to learn very much about the rest of the world by staying there. And that is one's right and one's privilege to do so. But one should be aware that they are kind of depriving themselves of a wide-ranging experience, which probably will help them make better decisions going forward. And an illustration of this would be, let's say that we have two people who are using the Google machine that we all are comfortable with to search for something. And they both, two different kinds of people, they both put in the word bacon. One of them is a vegan, and the other one is a person who loves bacon. So the same word, the person who's the vegan, it's not as if by magic that they hear how bacon is bad for you, very salty, cancer-causing, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That doesn't happen by chance. It happens because their behavior, I should say the things they have searched for, the things they have, the websites they have looked at, therefore the data that Google has collected about them over time informs the kind of search results that they are shown. And this is done under the guise of saying, well, we just want to show you more of what you're interested in. And that sounds great, except that it's really important to know that, for instance, older media, any non-social media really, and this includes everything from print to broadcast to radio, newspapers, and also, and this is another thing, it also includes all websites that aren't social media. They are all learning about, the digital ones are learning about what you're interested in, and they are able to, and these social media companies build a business on this. They learn about what you're interested in, and them or Google will then show you, based on the data they have collected about your interests online, they will then tailor the results that you see. So the vegan person, the reason why they see the bacon is bad links is because they have been looking at a bunch of bacon is bad links over time. So their behavior is recorded by Google. And even if Google doesn't know who that person is specifically, they don't know their name and they don't know their address, they do know the behavior of the person who is associated with that particular device and that particular range of IP addresses, if you will, which gets a little bit technical. But they essentially know the behavior and they tailor the results. The person who is a bacon lover also has their own online proclivities. They will have gone to how to smoke meat. They will go to, can I put bacon in an air fryer? All these kinds of things. Well, whereas the vegan person will have seen all the bad bacon stuff, the other person with the same search criteria will see a completely different set of results. That's because of the things they have looked at, and Google records that and says, this person is interested in that, and so I'm going to show them that. And so that is really the development of the echo chamber. And this is an essence of how social media works. They create audiences out of what people are interested in. And then they serve content to those audiences based on what they know about them. So that's the targeting part of what's going on. And that's why we have why people seem to it's one reason, in my personal opinion, why people seem to have such very, very divergent opinions about what is real and what is not real. And it comes down to what you've been exposed to. Now, in the old days, if we can remember those, before people got their news in social media, there were just a few ways to get the news. And I'm not saying that this was necessarily preferable, but it was a benchmark where everyone heard the same news more or less at the same time and from the same people. And if you were in Montana or if you were in Maine at 6 o'clock or 6:30 or whenever, the news would come on and the headlines would be read, and everyone would then agree, disagree, or ignore them. But there would be no case where one person would say the Titanic sank and another person would say it didn't. And that's unfortunately kind of where we are today. So why is it this way? Well, it's one thing to say be someone who wants to influence people, but how do you do that? You under FCC guidelines, if you will, it's frowned upon, not to say one could be fined or lose their license for lying repeatedly in such a way that would damage other people. And of course, the example of this would be Fox News, which is not protected by the aforementioned Section 230. And because they weren't, when a company called Dominion Voting Systems sued them for defaming Dominion Voting Systems over lies related to the 2020 election, Fox News was forced to settle for $750 million with Dominion Voting Systems. That's because they weren't protected by Section 230. But guess what? There are companies that are protected by Section 230 uniquely in all the world, and frankly, uniquely among all businesses, where they have zero liability for the product that they put out. And the product they put out is media. And I'm talking directly about the social media platforms, the Metas, the X's, the YouTubes of the world. And it's fascinating to point out that even as a Fox News was being forced to pay $750 million to Dominion Voting Systems because they were caught lying about the 2020 election, those very same lies continued and do continue to be I don't use the word broadcast, but promulgated and disseminated and promoted by social media companies. And the reason they can do that is because they have zero liability for anything that they publish on their vertically integrated media properties. So here's what Section 230 does for them, and in my opinion, what Section 30 does to the rest of us. So Section 230 gives them two rights. And in my opinion, these are rights that are mutually incompatible, logically inconsistent, and deleterious to civil discourse. Those rights being, the first one kind of makes sense, actually. They have the right, they're expressly given the right to decide whether they want to put something on their platform or whether they don't. And they cannot be forced to put anything on there that they don't want to put on there, which makes sense. These are private companies. And I'm going to get into this a little later about, you know, what is censorship. But these are private companies. They are not obligated to publicize anyone in particular. They are obligated to their shareholders to seek maximum profit at all times. And so the things that they decide to put on, should I say put on, meaning distribute, these are content units that they feel are going to help their business. And it's important to note that their business is to sell ads. They do not have a plan other than to sell ads and make money. So it's not as if they are, have a political reason to be doing this necessarily, or at least they shouldn't. We're seeing signs that X might be, but that's rather an anomaly, in fact, and it's only happened since Elon Musk bought it and took it private. But what they're doing is they're trying to sell ads, and what they have discovered, and this is another thing we'll need to spend more time on, is they've discovered that what gets people to stay on their platform long enough so that they can sell them, show them more ads, is discord and hatred and anger. These have been proven to be the things that keep people on the site for longest. And so this is kind of what they're tuned to do. And disinformation sources, which may come from anywhere, including overseas, are only too happy to oblige that. So getting back to that right, they can decide or not decide to put on any particular piece of content. Secondly, it gives them another right, which is really where their huge amount of profitability is sourced, okay? And that is that unlike any other company with any other product in the United States, they have total immunity for any damage that might be caused by anything that is distributed, said, or talked about on their properties. That sounds a little crazy to me, but I'll tell you why it was done in the first place. So back in the 1990s, which was about when I was first getting started in the digital trades, I was actually a computer illustrator back in those days, and I ended up building some websites, as I think I had mentioned. This was a time when no one had any idea that there would be anything like a social media. We weren't even sure that there would be much of a thing called the web. It was in its infancy, and it was a very scrappy affair where big companies were sort of scoffing at it, and it was considered to be a super, super niche discipline. And so in order to Congress saw fit to protect certain aspects of this. And the aspect that they're protecting were these little bulletin boards. that some of the older folks may remember places like CompuServe or even AOL or Prodigy. These were internet connectivity services that predated the web, and they were pretty much text only. And, you know, there was the whole you've got mail period where you'd hear that glitchy sound, and then you'd connect and there'd be a modem, and, you know, you really couldn't, you would never have been able to look at video. There was no bandwidth for it. But you could get text. And so there were these bulletin boards that were created. And these bulletin boards were pretty much exactly like the bulletin board you might see at the coffee shop or the library. They were digital versions of that. Someone would, for instance, say, I'm selling a bicycle. Call me at the following number. And really, that was about the limit of it. These bulletin boards did not have predictive algorithms. They didn't promote certain things over the other. It was really like a glorified classifieds ad, kind of like Craigslist used to be. But they were very simple and very basic. And so the thinking was, we want to make sure, Congress was saying this, we want to make sure that we allow these companies to grow and innovate without feeling like they are going to get shut down just because some lunatic decides to put an ad that is deeply offensive onto their system. It would be something like if you had the bulletin board at the coffee shop and someone posted, say, something like objectionable content, obscene content on the bulletin board. Okay. Now, of course, we would not want the coffee shop to be shut down and the owner fined because someone had done that on the bulletin board. Of course, the owner would be expected to take it down, but it would not be an automatic situation. And so similarly, they wanted to protect these electronic versions of this. And that all made sense. These were pretty small companies doing small bore stuff. And I think there was good reason for them to be protected. They were not very influential. They were about about as influential as the classified ads in the newspaper. And however, in today's environment, we have multi-billion dollar companies in a trillion-dollar business with not only unprecedented power, but exorbitant power that exceeds the power of all the other media companies combined, they are protected by this same law. So that if someone posts something, a call to violence, or a damaging lie, these companies can promote it, and they do promote it to their specific audiences that they know will like this kind of stuff, and they can do it all day and all night, and they will never have any liability. So a couple of examples of how that kind of plays out. The first one would be a situation where we know, for instance, that of course, you know, I'm going to go back a couple of years now and talk about a particular violent attack on Nancy Pelosi's husband, Speaker Nancy Pelosi, who lives in San Francisco and is a Democrat. And her husband, you know, they're both getting on in years. Her husband's in his 80s. Well, he was attacked by a hammer-wielding intruder, and he was injured. And it was learned not too long after the incident that this individual was self-admittedly radicalized to turn against a person like a Pelosi who he thought of as the quote unquote face of evil. Now, where did he get that from? He got that from repeated messaging to him and others within a narrow audience segment related to social media. So a lot of this comes in the form of YouTube videos, which YouTube's owned by Google, by the way, for those who didn't know this. So there would be videos about how one political personage or another was, quote unquote, the face of evil and must be destroyed. And, you know, and I know this is difficult to hear, but they would also say stuff like eats Christian babies and terrible, terrible calumnies against people. And it's not that the social media company made these up themselves or cared whether this was true or not true. It's that someone somewhere, probably with a political agenda, did make these things up and did leverage the social media site by putting it in there and the social media site just putting it out to the public in such a way that eventually a person like a John DePape, which is the name of the Pelosi attacker, became sufficiently radicalized that he believed he was on a mission to go and destroy the Speaker of the House of the U.S. Representatives with a hammer. And we don't need to get into the details of it, but she wasn't home, and that's why he attacked the husband. But he was sufficiently radicalized. He didn't just get there all on his own. He was sufficiently radicalized by content that he saw on very popular social media sites like YouTube, like X, like Meta/Facebook. And there, here's another example of how this works. And why it's so very dangerous. So there was several years ago, I believe the year was 2015, there was a terrorist attack on a nightclub in Paris. This was carried out by the terror group called ISIS. ISIS, of course, these days claims to no longer be carrying out operations. They are a media company. Because what they've discovered is that they can leverage social media to recruit, for instance, suicide bombers or people who want to kill other people. And they do this by creating YouTube videos that are enticing. And they use a lot of artificial intelligence, by the way, but that's another topic. But in essence, they are creating violent propaganda and invitations to violence. And they're deploying them on very profitable American platforms that do not stop them from putting it out there because they don't have to. Now, I'm not saying they don't want to, but because they don't have to, they often don't. And they will say, it's too hard for us. I have a bone to pick with it's too hard for us, but that's a whole nother discussion. Back to the Paris nightclub attack. So, unfortunately, a lot of people were killed there, as we know. One of the people killed there was an American, last name Gonzalez. The person who killed Ms. Gonzalez was a person who was admitted to having been radicalized by a number of recruitment videos put out by ISIS, but seen on American social media. So this person, like I said, was radicalized and executed the plan, killed a bunch of people. One of them was an American. Well, the father of this unfortunate girl was decided that he was going to go to court and try to sue Google under existing tort law. Essentially, what he was saying was that your product it was defective insofar as it contributed to the death of my daughter, and you knew that it was, and you allowed it to continue to happen. You knew that this was taking place, and yes, they do know this is taking place. And Gonzalez maintained that, this is it's called proximate cause liability under tort law. And it's not dissimilar to, let's say, if a particular car company put out a car that consistently steered to the right and ran into trees over and over and over again and killed people. And the car company did nothing to fix this. Eventually, that car company would get sued by victims, and that car company would lose a lot of money. However, his plan didn't work, and the reason it didn't work is because even though he was winning at the lower court levels, Google kept appealing, and they appealed it all the way up to the Supreme Court. And then the Supreme Court said, I'm sorry, Mr. Gonzalez, but you do not have a case. And the reason you don't have a case is because of Section 230. Section 230 absolves Google of any possible responsibility for any damage that is done based on what's on their platform. And so what we have is a situation where there are these gigantic media companies that have no liability for anything that they permit to be put out on their properties. This is totally unprecedented. It's unique in not only all media, it's unique in all business. There are no other businesses that have statutory non-liability for any harm that comes from their product. And if we go all the way back to the 1996 Act, we can see where that came from. It was meant to protect these very small bulletin boards. It was not meant to protect giant, hugely influential media companies. Okay? So I want to talk about another aspect of Section 230, which is incredibly unwieldy. And, there's, to tell you the truth, there actually is a bill in Congress today to sunset Section 230. It is sponsored by Congressman Pallone in New Jersey, and there's another congressperson in the state of Washington who's co-sponsoring it. She's a Republican, so it's a bipartisan bill. And it simply says we want to sunset this law. And this is why, because, there are people who recognize how bad it is. Unfortunately, there's just not enough people who recognize how bad it is, and certainly not enough in the United States Congress. So here is the kind of lowdown on what makes Section 230 as problematic as it is, and not just because of what I just described, but it's also logically inconsistent. And in fact, it's so logically inconsistent that I believe it approaches an air of I don't want to call unreality, but it almost puts them into what I call the legal equivalent of a quantum superposition, if you can bear that language. And I will explain what that means. It means that they can be two things simultaneously at once, which are diametrically opposed. So, for instance, and this gets very arcane, but quantum theory, very, very briefly, posits that the universe is made up of things, the position of which, and when talking about on an atomic level, we do not know what they are until we look at them. We do not know where they will be until we look at them. So there's an air of uncertainty until they are measured, and then they collapse into an actual state. But before then, they're in a state that could be either one. And here's why I'm using this. Because in law, there can't be anything like that. I'm talking about in legal law, there can't be anything like that, because that is, you can't be two things at once under the law. For instance, you cannot say that you're blind and then at the same time say that you're not blind. You can't literally be blind and at the same time be not blind. However, Section 230 makes it so that these companies can be blind and not blind at the same time, and they will, and you will only know which one they are when they decide to pick which one they are, depending on how well it suits them in that particular situation. And that's really the problem. So here's how that works. The blind part, okay, is the part where they have no liability, okay? It's because, and they will say that in this case, they operate like the phone company. Now, folks may not know this, but this is a fact. The phone company does not have any liability for anything that anybody says or does on a telephone. Someone could be plotting murder on a telephone, and the phone company wouldn't be able to stop it and would not be liable for it. Now, here, so this is very, very important. They're not; they wouldn't be allowed to stop it. They are not allowed to decide what you can talk about on the phone. They're called a carrier. All they do is set up the link, and everybody talks, and the phone company has no idea. Well, I'm not sure they have no idea nowadays, but they certainly didn't used to have any idea unless somebody tapped the phone. But they certainly weren't in the business of deciding who could say what on the telephone. So, of course, the social media companies will say, well, that's just like us. We don't have any control over what people put here, and we can't tell them what to say. And, okay, well, if that's true, then what's the deal with this other part of Section 230, which is the part where you're not blind? And not blind means that you can decide to have or not have any particular content on your site. You will be making editorial choices. A lot of times it is called content moderation. And they do employ people to look at content that is submitted, and if it's objectionable or unsuitable for their business, it just never gets on there. So that is an editorial choice, right? So that's something that the phone company, who has zero liability for what anybody says on their platform, right? They can't make any decisions about it. And here along comes social media, who can make decisions about what's on their platform. And they do make decisions about what's on their platform. So my contention is these two things are totally, totally incompatible. You can't say that you don't have a choice, except that you do have a choice. This amounts to a legal sleight of hand, which is deployed by these companies in order to escape liability. And frankly, they have managed to get away with this for a very, very long time. However, as I think we are seeing, our nation at this point in time is so deeply divided that a lot of people think that it might not be able to put back together anymore. And my submission to you is not that the facts are so very different, but that the disinformation that is purposely put out there by cynical manipulators who are leveraging these platforms to deliver their messages to the millions, the disinformation is on purpose. And the platforms essentially are handmaidens to this. They will put it out there. Because, A, it's profitable. B, they have no downside. getting rid of 230 wouldn't change anything except give them a downside in case someone like a Gonzalez was materially damaged. So let me I have only a couple of minutes left here. And so let me just wrap up with a brief discussion about censorship, because I'm sure that a lot of listeners are thinking, well, gee, if they went and, decided what could be on the site and what couldn't be on the site, isn't that censorship? This is a misnomer for editorial choice. I know that there's a lot of politicos out there and people who frankly have objectionable messages that they want to get out there. Many of them are the cynical manipulators themselves who want to leverage these huge publishing platforms to get their messages out. And to the extent that they are stopped from doing that, for instance, let's say somebody decides they want to recruit more people for ISIS, but somewhere in the content moderation office, they have noticed this and they said, no, you know what? That one with the, and I don't even want to talk about it because they're so disgusting, but that kind of behavior is not going to, we're not showing that, okay? So a person like that, or a cynical manipulator of sorts, and their political allies, I might add, which include a fair amount of American politicians, will say, the fact that you wouldn't put that on there is censorship. And I'm here to tell you that that is not censorship, that the reason it's not censorship is because it's no different than if you wrote a letter to the editor of a newspaper and the editor of the newspaper just didn't publish it, period. Would you have the right to go to that newspaper and say, you censored me? Of course not, and here's why. Is because that's not the only choice you have. If you can't get on social media, you can still buy a megaphone and you can stand out in front of your house and you can talk all day and all night and still somebody makes a noise complaint about that very same thing. You can print up a million handbills and hand them out everywhere in the United States and no one can do anything about it. You can do acrobatics in the park and someone else can hand out the handbills. I think you can see where I'm going with this. The notion that because one company decided that they didn't want your message on their platform is so far from being censorship that it's kind of an absurd proposition. Only the government can censor you. For instance, if a candidate for president, for instance, suggests that if you criticize the Supreme Court, you should go to jail, which one of them did, by the way, that is the equivalent of censorship. It may be interesting for folks to know, only the government can censor you. In other words, you say that and you go to jail, much as, let's say, in North Korea or Iran, a number of places like this, where if you say certain things, if you do certain things that are nonviolent but objectionable to the regime, you will be punished by the regime. It's not a matter of non-exposure. It's a matter of being punished and silenced, and that you would have to go to jail for saying those kinds of things. That's what censorship is. And so in wrapping up, I would just say, I want to thank all the listeners for tuning in to Wave Farm today. This is Wave Farm WGXC Accra, and this is Andrew Edwards with the Anti-Disinformation Show coming to you from downtown Catskill, and I'm hoping that everyone has a great evening. And I'm hoping to come back and talk a little bit more about some of these really, really important issues as we go forward. And so I think that's going to wrap it up for me here. And again, thank you so much for